Turning this evening to Psalm 101, a psalm of David, Psalm 101, and the first verse, I will sing of mercy and judgment. Unto thee, O Lord, will I sing. And our subject is David plans his reign. And this is a very remarkable psalm, most unusual in the book of Psalms. It is a great privilege for us to have it and for us to read it. It's an insight into King David. It's very stimulating to us. But I'll tell you what it's about. It's about David either looking forward to, looking ahead to, or just embarking on his reign, the reign over the United Kingdom, the reign over Israel and Judah, to which he had been anointed, the reign that had been prophesied. And though he'd been hounded endlessly, mercilessly by King Saul, and all his circumstances had been such as to indicate this would never happen, yet he looks forward to it and he makes pledges. And he writes, as it were, or sets in a psalm, a manifesto. So it's an insight into the king's thoughts. It's an insight into the kind of pledge that he kept alive on his lips all through his reign. Some people in the past have thought that this psalm was composed a very long time before the reign of David began. When he was being hounded by Saul, when he was such a victim, and he felt the injustice of the king's court and the unreasonableness and the hatred and the lies, the godlessness of the king's court. And some people, noble expositors of the past, have imagined David in those circumstances, looking ahead and thinking to himself and vowing before God, when I reign, it won't be anything like this. My court will be composed of people of sterling worth. My court will be composed, my administration will be made up of people with integrity, of sterling worth. And I vow to set an example and to watch my words and my ways and to walk in accordance with the rules of the Lord. So some people thought he was looking ahead when he composed this psalm. And others say it was much later, and indeed at the very beginning of his reign. It doesn't much matter. You think you can see evidence for one time or another, but it really doesn't much matter. What matters is that this is his pledge, and it is a psalm of vows and pledges all the way through. Let me just show you very briefly to introduce you to the theme. In verse 1, you'll find there are two I wills. In verse 2, there are also two I wills. In verse 3, there's one. In verse 4, there's one. In verse 5, there are two I wills. In verse 6, there's an I will, but it's slightly differently translated. It takes the shall be form. And then in verse 8, there's an I will. So I don't think there's any argument. It's a psalm of pledges. It's one great vow. It's a statement of his intention and his plans for when he's king or having embarked upon his reign. It's a tremendous insight. Now there's something very significant about this. When you look at the kind of things he pledges himself to and the undertakings he makes, the promises he makes to God, they're very different from anything that you would get from most earthly rulers, however good, however noble their intentions. You get, and this is not a criticism, but you get a new prime minister, or in monarchies you get a ruler, a despot, a dictator, a king, whatever, and they'll often make a grand statement of the things they'll do. They'll lift up the poor, they'll do all kinds of things, and the promises they make are not so much personal undertakings, but optimistic statements of policy. I will look to do this and to do that and so on, rather like a queen's speech. They're full of political moves and ideas, ideals and aims. But you won't see anything like that in David's statement. It's not really a political manifesto at all. It's a statement which says, I will be a worshipper. I will set an example. I will take heed to my ways. I will do my utmost to promote in my own life moral and ethical conduct. I will make up my administration of people who seek and love the Lord and walk with him and live holy lives and keep to the truth. It's all along those lines. It's a highly religious statement. I will pledge myself. I will live in this way. I will only hire and appoint and employ people in my administration. He calls it his house in the psalm. But it includes his personal house. It's his administration, his court he refers to. Of course, it is all about his reign. And it's about their morality and their faithfulness and their purity of life. So it's quite stunning. You will never find that sort of thing, generally, outside the Bible. And yet it's an example to us in our homes, in our church. There are many ancient expositors who take this as a prophetic psalm. And they say, David said all these things, and he certainly meant them, and he didn't live entirely up to them, but he endeavored to come back to them repeatedly in his life. But what the psalm really reflects, it speaks prophetically of Christ and who he will have in his kingdom and who will he will appoint as his people and his servants on earth and what he will expect of them in their moral behavior and their honesty and their faithfulness. And it's true, because everything David says is prophetic. In a sense, it applies to him, it applies to us, and it speaks of Christ. And he speaks now as the one who is anointed to be king, and the administration he will bring in and operate. So let's look at it from the very beginning. I'm going to take up three elements in this psalm. The first element, or heading, will be David's dedication to God. That's the most significant thing. The second element will be his cry and his desire for divine involvement, for divine interventions, for divine action to mark his reign. That's the second most precious thing to him, that he will be able to trace the hand of God and observe the help of God, the overturning power of God in everything that he does. And then thirdly, the spiritual defense. He's very conscious that this is going to be a warfare, that it's a war against the devil, the enemy of souls, that there are haters of the Lord and his word out there, and he's going to have to protect the kingdom against them and against evildoers. So he's very, very conscious of a war, a warfare. So there are those three elements that you can see clearly in the psalm: dedication, the desire for divine action, and the need for spiritual defense. So beginning at verse 1, I will sing. And the intention of David is to say, not just I will sing, but this is the language he uses for the writing of psalms. I will create, I will compose a psalm. That's virtually what he says. I will compose a psalm. This is something that is ongoing, future and ongoing. He's going to sing along certain lines. Why is this here? Well, his pledge he's going to set into the form of a psalm. Why does he wish to do that and to publish it? His personal, private intentions for holiness and for obedience to God, well, he wants to publish them because he wants to think about them constantly. He wants to check himself by them. He wants to make himself accountable to himself and to God. So he's going to set it in stone. He's going to write it out and have it sung as a psalm. There are those experts in these things who produce evidence for the possibility that this 101st psalm was frequently sung at coronations of kings of Judah down the centuries afterwards, whether they meant them as David did or stuck to the terms as David did, we cannot say, but that's quite likely that this became an ongoing coronation psalm, particularly for the kings of Judah. I will sing, I will pen a psalm, and all my desires and intentions for my reign will be here. But he begins the song, I will sing of mercy and judgment. And as the first verses of the psalm are very personal, I think it would be wrong to interpret this as though he is merely saying, when I reign, I will show mercy and I will exercise good judgment. Of course, he sought to do those things. But I believe, and this is the prevailing opinion of the old writers, that he's making a theological statement, because all the things he goes on to say are about his own personal behavior and his own frame of heart. And so he's not talking yet about how he will reign as king. He's pledging himself morally to the standards of God. And he begins by saying, I will sing of mercy and judgment, God's mercy to me. I am reigning by his mercy. I never deserved to be king. He called me, and in his own way he prepared me for it. He has forgiven my sins. He's washed away my unworthiness and my crimes. And the Hebrew word for verdict is translated here judgment. And you could say then, it's a theological statement. I will sing of God's mercy to me and of justification by faith, if you like, of God accepting me and pronouncing a verdict over me that I am forgiven and I am accepted. It's a theological personal statement, much more than a general statement about wanting to be a merciful and a just king in his administration of affairs. That would not so much so well fit with what follows. And that's good for us too. Always we are praising God for mercy and for justification by faith, for our acceptance through Christ. And then he says in verse 1, unto thee, O Lord, will I sing. And the thrust of that statement is that he is going to direct his mind and his words to the true and living God with all his sincerity. He is going to so sing and so pray as though he believes with all his heart that God is there and God is hearing him. He's going to be reverent and careful. So he'll sing of his mercy and the verdict of God toward him in receiving him undeservedly. And he's always going to sing directly to him with sincerity. I will behave myself wisely, he says, in a perfect way. I will behave myself warily, you could translate it, carefully, like a person taking a journey with all sorts of dangers and pitfalls. What may be lurking behind the next tree or mass of scrub? I must proceed carefully. He's going through terrain, possibly with wild beasts. I will behave myself wisely, circumspectly, warily, carefully. When I am king, everything I do I will think about. And I will think about the implications. And I will think about the spiritual implications. That's dedication. That's how we should live. We dedicate now the autumn to the Lord. How are we going to live? Great decisions will sweep across our lives. We won't take them lightly, suddenly, easily, as though with all our ability and experience we can handle all things from our own judgments. We shall proceed warily and carefully, as though every great decision may involve a pitfall, a snare, spiritually. Just a minute, we'll say. We will pray this too. We will look to see the implications of what we propose to do. We will look to see the example towards others. We will be a careful people for the Lord. And when David pledges himself for his future kingdom, his language is very challenging to us. I will behave myself wisely, circumspectly, in a perfect way. The Hebrew word is a complete way, an entire way. In other words, what David means to say is this: I will always keep my eye on my entire life. You know, we read of various nations in the world, even today, where the rulers amass vast fortunes and huge bank accounts in Switzerland, where the foreign aid that's given to them somehow finds its way into their own coffers. We read of these things, of places where the rule is unjust. And so you say, well, that ruler, in many ways, he may be very efficient. He may maintain order in his country, may not, on the other hand. He may defend his realm and so on. But he's not conducting himself wisely in an entire way, because a whole chunk of his life is swindling and stealing and enriching himself. That's the sense that we have here from David. I will behave myself wisely in an entire way, a perfect way, across the whole of my life. I'll watch every aspect, not only my public deportment, but my private life and my private deportment. I stand before God on both fronts, and I will be careful. This is his pledge, and that's our pledge too, or it should be. I will not only be a great learner of doctrine, I will make sure that I am a faithful witness too. I will not only be one who learns the theology, I will learn the life also and the conduct. I will behave myself wisely across the entire Christian life. So help me God, by the enabling of the Lord. And I will seek to do this sincerely, leaving nothing out. That's the meaning of David. I will behave myself circumspectly, warily, in a complete or in an entire way, and not be a partial hypocrite. So, first of all, there is his pledge to God, and it concerns himself and his life, and we'll pick up more of that as we go on. But I want now to introduce the second theme, and the second theme in the psalm is this: he desires the involvement, the evident, obvious involvement of the Lord in his life. Halfway through verse 2, O when wilt thou come unto me? Now there have been all sorts of guesses about the meaning of this prayer of David's, when wilt thou come unto me? Some have thought that it's his way of saying, when will my reign over the United Kingdom begin? But it can't possibly be that, out of the blue, when he's talking about personal things, his personal walk with God. When he's king, this is going to be the most important thing, his personal walk and his relationship with God. Others have thought, oh, what he's probably referring to here is the ark, which is still not in Jerusalem. Well, when will the ark be returned to Jerusalem for my reign? But that's probably a bit of a leap too far, because there's no mention of the ark. There's no reason why David should be speaking of that. The most likely thing is that David is simply speaking of his longing to have constant evidence of the Lord's involvement in his life and interventions in his life. That's what he desired when he was king. He would know the power of God. He wouldn't rely on horses and chariots, because the Lord had decreed that the children of Israel should not rely on horses and chariots. He denied them the usual accoutrements of war so that they would prove their faith in him and his power. They would take the sword and he would enable them when they had to defend themselves or venture into battle. And David knew that. He wasn't going to break that. What he desires is that God will manifest himself in all his trials, in all his perplexities and his great decisions that he would have to take, that he would have a constant flow of evidence of the blessing and power of God. He'd know God answering his prayers and being with him. And that's a great pledge for us too. Don't be content to live the Christian life by faith only, in the sense that you trust God and you believe in him and you love him, but you don't expect to see him operating in your life. Long for the evidence of the hand of God. In what way will it come? In what way will you see it? Well, you pray and you receive answers to your prayers, and your Sunday school children are moved in your class, and their hearts are opened and they listen and they're blessed of God, and you're strengthened at times when you're exhausted, and yet an opportunity is before you, and you pray to the Lord and he helps you and he sees you through and strengthens you, and you know he's with you, and something's going wrong. One of your besetting sins, your old sins, has returned. I don't know what it might be. Perhaps you're getting very testy or bad-tempered. Something entirely different. And it's revisiting itself. And you're being rude to your wife or to your husband or whatever. And running out of patience. All kinds of things. And you pray to God to help you and to put you back on the track. And you've tried to control yourself and you've failed. But because you pray, you have the certain and wonderful evidence of the power of God in your life. And you've got strength over that sin again. And you can please the Lord. And you can check your words. And you can behave calmly and rationally and sensibly. And you praise and thank God. And you know that he came to your aid and he delivered you. You have help in holiness. You have help understanding the scripture. You have help in witness. You prayed for opportunities. And look, they've come along. You didn't have an opportunity for weeks. And you redoubled your efforts in prayer. And then there came a wonderful opening, a tremendous opportunity. And it was the evidence you needed that the Lord was with you. And then you've been perplexed about what you should do. And the Lord has opened doors in answers to your prayer for guidance, unmistakably. And you've had provisions, perhaps in your housing need or in your employment need, when you've really depended upon the Lord. Then perhaps after a period of testing, he's blessed you. And you've been sick and you've been ill, and God has seen you through and helped you and heard your cries. Dear friends, desire these demonstrations that God is involved in the lives of his people and that he's the hearer and the answerer of prayer. Oh, when wilt thou come unto me? And David knows the terms. He repeats what he said before. I will walk within my house with a perfect heart, an entire heart, genuineness. If we are sincere and genuine people, examining our hearts and desiring to please him, he will help us. He will intervene. He will be involved, and we'll praise him and thank him. And that's the most precious aspect of the Christian life, an experiential Christian walk. And then we proceed to a third heading, and that is spiritual defense. And look at verse 3, the spiritual defense that David is concerned about. He will defend his own heart, the spiritual warfare. I will set no wicked thing before mine eyes. I will set no, your marginal reading will suggest, thing of Belial. And that's making full use of the Hebrew term. I will set no thing of Belial, no worthless thing before mine eyes. Wicked is perfectly good, but when you have Belial brought into it, that prince of demons, you realize that this is all about the campaign of the world against God. I will not have before my eyes anything which is part of this world's campaign against God. Satan is at work. There's a spiritual warfare. He is seeking to bring us down personally. He's seeking to ruin our churches. He will employ all kinds of means, but in this world, he has set up, he has engineered, he has authored things which are ultimately against the Lord and against his truth. And they encourage atheism, self-determination, unbelief. They encourage all these things. They encourage sexual misconduct, all kinds of moral misconduct. I will set no thing of Belial before mine eyes. Nothing that has anything to do with this world's campaign. Satan's campaign in the world. Well, dear friends, we remind you of these things often. But an astonishing thing is happening in the churches of Christ in these last days. Mostly in the past, the devil's attacks have come in two forms. Either in physical persecution, to discourage people from worship and seeking after the Lord, and to destroy the preaching of the word. He still uses that method in many countries, but that has been a very popular device of Satan, persecution. It doesn't altogether work, because the effect of persecution by the blessing of God is very often to strengthen the resolve of the people of God and to prune out those who are not serious and sincere and to stiffen the backs of those who really love the Lord. Another of his methods is false doctrine. The Church of Rome has been used for centuries by him. Theological liberalism and unbelief. And in every generation, he comes with false teaching to draw away people who are seeking after God and to confuse their understanding and to wreck the preaching of the gospel if he can. But now, as never before, there is a device, a strategy employed by the devil, which is to make the people worldly, to penetrate the church with the very entertainments and culture and ideas that he employs in the world to take people away from God, to give them desire for sinful things, to encourage unbelief and self-determination and all the things which take people away from God. And the churches are letting these things in. Dear friends, David says, I will set no thing of Belial, nothing to do with the prince of the power of the air and his schemes and strategies before mine eyes. I hate the work. He doesn't say actually he hates them, but he says carefully before God, I hate the work of them that turn aside, of those who will turn the people of God to idolatry in his day, to compromise, to be like the nations around them, to go in for fleshly things and pomp and circumstance rather than worship and trust in God. I hate the destructive, damaging, harmful work of them that turn aside. It shall not cleave to me. I will have nothing at all to do with it. I will not adopt those things. Today, David would say, I will not adopt the music of the world. I will not adopt these thunderous, rhythmic, visceral forms of music, which are to entertain and to enslave and to bring into bondage. I will not touch them. But today, tragically, we get many Bible-believing churches, and they say, we want this. We like this. I was speaking to somebody some time ago, not of this church, who wanted to sing a particular song, which was written by one of these leading contemporary Christian music composers. And he said to me, well, this particular song is sound. Well, it was just about. Wasn't particularly deep. Had many faults and failings in it. But you couldn't say it was unsound. It was reasonably sound. But of course, it was entirely written to suit genre, the culture of the rock world. And that's how this man proceeds. This one, this particular song, was not so bad as some of them. Why would you want to sing that song and identify with that? And here was the reply. And this was very significant to me. Because I like it. And because I was blessed through it. Really? Imagine you're back in World War II. And somebody says to you, I like Hitler. I think he's rather appealing. Well, I don't understand what he's saying. And it sounds hair-raising. They might say, I don't understand German. I look at his face, and I think he's got character, and he's probably a nice man. So I'm going to start a Hitler Appreciation Society. And I'm going to tell all my friends how I like him very much. What would you say to somebody in the middle of a war when there's such evil and destruction? You would probably say to them, that's the most selfish statement I ever heard. You like him, and you're not giving any consideration to the evil and the harm and the damage and the killing and the whole mission of the man and purpose of the man. And I said to this person who wanted to sing a song by a particular contemporary Christian music composer, you like him. And you don't mind if other people learn to like him through you, or you don't mind if singing that song commends him and opens people's minds to the whole error, the deathly error that this represents, bring the world into the church, and do just what you like, because somebody who conducts himself appallingly in a sinful worldly way manages, probably by the help of Satan, occasionally, to write something which is technically sound, and you're going to like it and appreciate it and support it and run with it. Well, that's high treason against the Lord, against the word, against the truth. We can't think like that, dear friends. Listen to David. I will set no thing of Belial before mine eyes. I hate the work, the damage they do, of them that turn aside. It shall not cleave to, stick to me. We have to be separate and pledge ourselves to God to be separate from all these harmful, degrading influences. And that's the pledge of David. He knows about the spiritual warfare. Of course, people today who say, oh, I like that. I happen to like that. It blessed me. They've got no notion of spiritual warfare. If they're really saved at all, they've never noticed that they're in a war against the world, the flesh, and the devil. And they're conducting themselves as though there's no trouble, no difficulty, no war to fight, no loyalty to show, no backbone to possess. I hate the work of them. I'm not saying you must hate those people. pity them, even pray for them, but hate the harm they do, because they do immense, colossal harm to the work of the Saviour. Look at verse 4. A froward heart shall depart from me. I will not know a wicked person. This word froward, it's most interesting. Sometimes a Hebrew word is used and translated froward, which means something like contrary. But often, and this is the word that's used here, it's a Hebrew word that means knotted, knotted up. Something which is knotted. A knotted heart shall depart from me. In other words, somebody who is so twisted and perverted in his views that he's not going to change. He's not open to repentance. He's not open to persuasion. He's fixed and determined in his views. If I come across a person who is fixed and determined in idolatry, in worldliness, David says, in anything like that, well, I shall just dismiss him. He won't get an audience. I won't interact with him. If he's a person of prominence, I won't negotiate with him, deal with him, appoint him to anything official. A froward set, twisted, perverted, knotted, someone who can't be unraveled, can't be persuaded. Oh, life is full of people, and we've all done it, who make great mistakes and do wrong things. And in the blessing of God, a Christian says, you shouldn't be doing that. This is what the scripture says. And if we're open to persuasion by the blessing of God, then show patience, persuade them in a right direction, help them. But if they're stuck and determined where they are, all they can do is harm you. So then the set, determined heart shall depart from me. I will not know a wicked person. And then David turns, and we have just a few moments to deal with this. He turns in verse 5, whoso secretly slandereth his neighbour, him will I cut off. I won't have anything to do with him. What's this about? Well, of course, today it would fit slander. In the household of God, we shouldn't have slanderers, gossips. But what is in mind here is David's rule. There are some people who will always approach a ruler, and they will talk down other people and slander them so that they get the office and the trust, and they work their way in by this. And this is what David is talking about. We've got to be so careful of that in the churches. There are people who work their way in. They say they believe things they don't. And we've got to watch out for deception. Him that hath an high look and a proud heart will not I suffer. David wouldn't have people who were conspicuously proud in his court. It wasn't entirely consistent with this. He had one or two generals, as you know, who were shockers. And they let him down and hurt his cause. But in the church of God, in the eldership, in those who serve, we don't want to see people who think so well of themselves, puffed up and obviously proud and self-seeking. We keep to humility and a desire to please the Lord. Mine eyes, says David in verse 6, shall be upon the faithful of the land, faithful to God, that they may dwell with me. I'm persuaded he's not so much talking about his personal home, but it includes that, as his administration, his court. He that walketh in an entire way, consistent, he's not a hypocrite, he's concerned about his whole life. He that walketh in an entire way, he shall serve me. He that worketh deceit shall not dwell within my house. He won't be in my administration. He that telleth lies shall not tarry in my sight. I will early, the 8th verse, because I've spent too long on the first part of the psalm, so I must hurry to conclusion. Verse 8, I will early, and the word translated early actually means a little more than that. You could say, I will constantly. Destroy, the verb is cut off. I will constantly cut off. Isn't necessarily talking about killing them. It's talking about cutting them off from influence and rule and a place in his administration. I will constantly cut off all the wicked of the land, these sons of Belial, that I may cut off all wicked doers from the city of the Lord. As far as David is concerned, his land is the church. His royal court serves the church of his day. And he's going to keep it clear in his own life and in all who serve the Lord in that church. Well, we've looked briefly at three things. His dedication, I will sing of mercy and judgment. His desire for divine action, oh, when wilt thou come unto me? And his concern to defend his people against the wiles and tricks of the devil. He'll keep his heart, his house, his church. David plans his reign. His psalm of dedication, read it, dear friends, privately, with understanding, and be challenged by it, and frame from it your own great prayer of dedication. Let's close singing together the hymn 517. Hymn number 517. Heaven is our destiny.